crazy. 3 weeks ago, I began to share with you guys my very own simple, in plain English, step-by-step guide for how you actually can make Jesus your treasure in real life, right? I've called it my very own treasure hunting for not dummies, but beginners, treasure hunting for beginners guide. And I only made it through one step, typical pastor mode right there. I made it through one step, but that one step I think is pretty significant. The first step, if you really want to make Jesus your treasure in your actual life and not just talk about it on Sunday, you need to investigate Jesus. You really need to get started by figuring out whether or not this Jesus guy is for real or not. You need to read. You need to explore the stories about him. You need to talk to Jesus' friends. You need to really think this through, okay? You need to decide what you think and what you believe about Jesus. Because the old days of my biology teacher told me, that show on the History Channel told me, my parents told me, my pastor told me, those days are over. That is no longer good enough. Jesus and figuring out whether or not he is real is way too important to hand it off to your biology teacher or your parents, even your pastor. You've got to figure this out for yourself. We cannot afford to be lazy about this. Because the reality is Jesus cannot be our treasure if we've never actually looked at the evidence and made up our own mind. Because we'll always be on the fence. We'll always wonder. We'll always be open to maybe changing our mind tomorrow. So start this step process by investigating Jesus. And now it's going to take you some time. You can't just make up your mind in 5 seconds or 5 minutes, as much as preachers sometimes like to think that if you just listen to their amazing sermon, by the end, you'll be 100% convinced. I know it doesn't work that way for most people. It's going to take some time, but if it takes time, that's fine. Take whatever time you need to figure this out for yourself. Now, you and I both know that at some point in your life, though, you're going to have to come to a conclusion. You're going to have to decide something about this Jesus person. And if you decide that Jesus isn't who he claimed to be, isn't the treasure worth pursuing in your life, well then, you have my permission to be sort of exempt, I guess, from the rest of this series because it'll be probably pretty boring for you. But if you come to the opposite conclusion, if you do your investigation and you conclude that Jesus is the real deal, that he really is who he claimed to be, and that he's worth pursuing, then there's another step that I want to share with you today that you're going to need to take in order to make Jesus your treasure. In order for him to satisfy the deepest cravings of your life, there's something else you need to do. But in order for that step to make sense, I'm going to have to tell you a story first. And it's a story that emerges from the biblical text. And what I want to do is I want us to look at this story today, and we're going to break this story down into three parts. And once I come to the end of the story, you'll see for yourself what that second step is in this process. Now, I'm going to start with what I'm calling a complicated backstory. Have you ever noticed in a book or a movie, sometimes they need to kind of tell you how the character got to be at that point where we find themselves in the story? It's called their backstory. And I need to tell you a story about one of Jesus' very first followers in his lifetime. This guy was a brash, hot-headed fisherman by the name of Simon. Now, Jesus had recruited Simon pretty early on in his wandering around the area countryside, preaching and teaching. He recruited Simon to be one of his followers, and Simon actually was not convinced at first. Simon was a little bit put-offish. Simon was actually a little bit cynical. So if you have a little bit of a cynic bent to your personality, you may be able to get along a little bit with Simon. But here's the thing I've found about cynics. When you finally win over a cynic, then you win them over. They are convinced. And Peter was absolutely like that. It took him a while to kind of dive in, but once he dove in head first. He became the vocal leader of the disciples. In other words, he would be the guy that would say out loud the stuff that everybody else is thinking. okay? Now, sometimes that was really good and really smart and like high five Peter, right? And then there's other times when he says things that probably should never have been said by anybody, okay? And in those moments, it was kind of like low five Peter. That's not exactly what we're going for, right? He and Jesus were really close. You need to understand this. Peter was one of the 12 inner circle disciples, but even within that inner circle, he seems to have been a little bit even more inner circle. Him, his friends, James and John, seem to be kind of like the three tightest disciples with Jesus. Let me just give you some examples of how Jesus and Simon were close. For one thing, Jesus would answer Simon's question. Simon, all the time, again, he's the one willing to say it out loud, right? So Simon would come up to Jesus, and probably the other disciples were like, would you go ask him, because we don't want... And Peter would be like, Simon would be like, hey, Jesus, so how many times should I forgive my brother when he sins against me? How about seven? Can we cut it off at seven? And Jesus was like, no, right? You remember the story, maybe, if you've been around this and heard it. You know, it's not seven, Simon, it's 70 times seven, which either means 490 if you're into math, or 77. But either way, it dwarfs our human expectations, right? But Jesus actually answered Simon's questions. Simon actually needed to be put in his place sometimes, and Jesus lovingly and sometimes harshly did that for him. Have you ever had somebody in your life who was needed to bring you, kind of put you in your place, cut you down to size? Jesus did that for Simon. Jesus gave Simon important responsibilities. Along with the other disciples, Jesus would send Simon and his friends out two by two throughout the countryside to spread the message of the kingdom of God. This is a big deal. Jesus even healed Simon's mother-in-law. Now, Simon may have wondered on some days if that was a blessing or not, I don't know. But the mother-in-law was sick, and Simon, Jesus went to the house and healed her. Jesus even gave, this is how you know they were close. Jesus even gave Simon a cool nickname, okay? We know of Simon today by his other name, the nickname Jesus gave him, which is Peter. There are churches all over the world and statues all over the world that are named after his character. Well, that's a nickname. It means Rocky. So if basically, he called him Rocky. That was his nickname for Peter. And he would used it as a sign of, you're a rock, Peter. You're a solid guy. You're a good guy. He and Jesus were really close. Now, this really became important the week of Jesus' death. There was a big festival going on in the city of Jerusalem, which was the capital city of Israel. And at that time, they would gather together on one night, the night of Passover, and little family groups and groups of friends would get together and celebrate a feast, which would kind of remember the time when God had set his people free from slavery down in Egypt. If you are curious about that, want to kind of go back, the book of Exodus talks about the children of Israel leaving Egypt, and as they did that, they had a special feast to celebrate their rescue from Egypt, because it was kind of a big deal. Okay, slaves for 400 years, and then you're not anymore, you have a holiday. It's just how you get off work, and it's great. And so that night, Jesus was celebrating that feast with his 12 closest friends and probably a few other people that were a part of that room. And at that meal, Jesus spilled the beans to his disciples that one of the 12 inner circle guys who had lived with Jesus, walked with Jesus, done everything with Jesus, one of those 12 would betray him, and then eventually all the 12, when Jesus needed them the most, would abandon him, turn tail, and run to save their own necks. Now, what I want you to know about Peter's personality is notice how he responds when Jesus says, you all are going to abandon me. You're all going to run away to save your own neck. This is how Peter responds, and it shows you a little bit of what Peter was like. Peter answered him, though they, can you just see him in the room? Like, they're there. Okay, they can hear him say this. Even if all of those people, right, fall away because of you, I will never fall away. And Jesus said to Peter, truly, I tell you, this very night, before the rooster crows, you will deny me, how many times? Three times. But Peter said to him, so even that wasn't enough, right? Peter said to him, even if I must what? Die with you, I will not deny you. And just so that we know that it's not just Peter, all the disciples, Sorry, that's my fault. All the disciples said what? Oh yeah, me too, Jesus, me too, me too. That very night, it happens. Now, I'll be honest with you, there's a little bit of tough guy bluster here in this Simon Peter guy. He talks a big game, doesn't he? But what it does is it shows you his intentions. Peter intended to be a loyal and faithful follower of Jesus, even if it meant what? His own physical death. But later that night, we're not talking like a week later, a month later, a year later, later that night, the soldiers showed up for Jesus. And Simon Peter ran away like everybody else. Abandoned Jesus to his fate. Left him there to die. But for Simon, it gets a little bit worse, right? Jesus actually was snuck, he was taken into custody, he was put on trial that night. It was a totally illegal procedural process for normally dealing with these things, but they wanted to kind of really quick sneak him under the radar so they could execute him or get rid of him before the crowds figured out what was going on. And so they have Jesus in this kangaroo court about to get totally falsely accused and a charge and everything. During that trial, Simon Peter sneaks into the outer courtyard where that trial is happening. And I imagine he comes because he's desperate for some news. And then, as Jesus prophesied, this is what happened. Peter was sitting outside in the courtyard, and a servant girl came up to him and said, "Hey, you also were with Jesus the Galilean." But he denied it before them all, saying, "I do not know what you mean." And when he went out to the entrance, another servant girl saw him, and she said now to the bystanders, "This man was with Jesus of Nazareth." And again, he denied it, this time with what? With an oath. Now, an oath isn't just like, you know, using a random curse word. This is saying, "I swear by the God of heaven, I do not know this man." After a while, the bystanders came up and said to Peter, "Certainly you too are one of them, for your accent betrays you." He was from the northern part of the country, and they must have talked differently than the people in the south. And so he's like, "Okay, buddy." And what does Peter do? He began to invoke a curse on himself and to swear. He basically said, "May God burn me in hell forever if I am lying about this. I do not know the man." And immediately the rooster crowed. And Peter remembered the saying of Jesus, "Before the rooster crows, you will deny me," how many times? Three times. And he went out and he wept bitterly. Friends, this is the kind of failure that can absolutely destroy a life. Judas was one of the other 12. Judas is famous, and the reason there aren't a lot of Judases running around in the world today is because Judas was the one of the 12 who actually turned Jesus in to the authorities, betrayed his master and friend in order to get 30 pieces of silver. Judas failed in a very similar way that Peter did here, and Judas couldn't handle the guilt. You remember what happened to Judas, right? His guilt overwhelmed him. He felt regret and remorse, and he knew he couldn't fix it. So what did he do? He ran out, couldn't handle the guilt, took his own life. Peter didn't quite handle it that way. We do know he went out and wept bitterly. But then what Peter does is he hides himself away, carrying that guilt with him. Now my question, I wonder, he probably expects Jesus to die, and that's the end of the story. I wonder, was he planning to like sneak out with the crowds when the crowds are done with their festival and they all go back home? Was he planning on laying low for a couple of days and then just sneaking out of town and going back home and going back to his old life? Either way, Jesus surprised everybody, literally everybody, when he came back to life 3 days later. Now, that sounds great on the surface, and it is, okay? It's great. It's actually the best news ever. But what if your final memory with this person who has come back to life is that you denied him three times in front of people and called down curses upon yourself to say, "I don't know the man"? How would you feel if you heard that Jesus was back from the dead? The person you just betrayed. The person you just abandoned. And now he's back. I didn't expect that was going to happen, right? I mean, at best, the first time Peter sees Jesus after the resurrection, it's awkward, right? At best. At worst, I'm wondering if Peter's worried about punishment. If Peter's worried about retaliation. You know, he literally came back from the dead. What is he going to say? What is he going to do? And if I'm Peter, I wonder this question. After I talked such a big game about how I would die with you, and even if all these other people abandon you, I'll even die with you, and then to fail like that, how in the world do you come back from that kind of a failure? How do you ever face Jesus, look him in the eye, and move forward? I imagine that must have been difficult. And the reason I do this isn't just a fun little psychological questioning. We have a text, a story, that actually explores how Peter handled this sense of failure and this sense of his relationship with Jesus. And it's found in the book of John, chapter 21. I'd like to invite you to open up your copy of the Bible to John 21. We have a lot of extra Bibles in the seats in front of you. Feel free to grab one of those and open up to page 907. 907. That's where we're going to spend talking about this story. And remember, eventually we're going to get to a second step that you need to take in making Jesus your treasure. We'll get there. Trust me, if you can. John chapter 21, let's notice how Peter handles his ongoing relationship with Jesus in spite of his horrible failure. John 21 verses 1 through 3 says this. After this, Jesus revealed himself again to the disciples by the Sea of Tiberias. If you're curious about what that is, today we call that same sea the Sea of Galilee. Okay, up in the northern part of Israel. So we're away from Jerusalem, we're back in Galilee, which is Peter's stomping grounds. That's where he grew up. That's where his family's from, that's where his wife and his family live, all up there by the Galilee, by the Sea of Tiberias. And Jesus revealed himself in this way. Verse 2, Simon Peter, Thomas, called the twin, Nathanael of Cana in Galilee, the sons of Zebedee, that's James and John, if you're keeping track at home, and two others of his disciples were together. They were all hanging out, spending time together. Most of Jesus' disciples were from the northern part of the country. And Simon Peter said to them, I'm going fishing. They said to him, we will go with you. They went out, got into the boat, but that night they caught nothing. Now, this I want to suggest to you something. This is not just Peter chilling with his bros, going out to blow off some steam because we've had a really stressful couple of weeks with Jesus dying and coming back to life again. This isn't Peter wanting a pleasure time with his friends, just kind of sit back and maybe catch something, maybe not, just enjoy. When you think of fishing, most of the time we think pleasure. We think going out, hang out, have fun, relax, feel the breeze, you know, stick your feet in the water while you're doing it, and have a good time. That is not what Peter is talking about here. How do we know this? For a couple reasons. Number one, he was a fisherman. That was his job before Jesus showed up. Okay? Peter, I don't know if you have this thing where whatever you do for a career, even if some people do that for fun, you have a hard time doing that for fun. Like, can I just let you in on one of my personal struggles? I read the Bible for a living. That's kind of what I do. And sometimes I have to fight really hard to sit down and just read it for pleasure because I'm doing it all the time during the week for my job, but I know I need to do it for pleasure. Well, Peter was a fisherman. I doubt he went fishing to relax because he's a fisherman. He's always thinking about where the best catch is and where I should go and what time of the day and are the nets in good order and so on. I imagine his mind had a hard time shutting off. We also know another thing is that he fished during the nighttime. He fished over the night. Now that was the time when the fishermen would typically, the professionals, would go out to catch fish, was at nighttime. So it seems like it's more than just some kind of relaxation and rest time with my friends and relaxing. I think what Peter is doing here is he is done. He's done. He's lived the last 3+ years walking with Jesus, talking with Jesus, doing what Jesus wanted him to do. And I think he's come to the point, it's been a few days after the resurrection, the excitement has died down a little bit, and he's like, you know what? I'm going back. Going back to my old life. I'm pulling back. I'm walking away from this crazy life that Jesus had called me into. And the funny thing, did you notice? He's got company. Okay, one person makes a decision, he's been an influential person, there's 6 other guys in the boat. Now we know the sons of Zebedee, James and John, were professional fishermen, but the other 3 guys, as far as we know, they had never been professional fishermen in their life. But they're like, you know what, if Peter's given up, well, I might as well too, and maybe I'll do what he's doing. So they join him in the boat, and shocker, totally unsuccessful. Doesn't catch a single fish. Now, I haven't time traveled back to the first century to find out if that happened all the time or not. So I don't know. I can't give you that historical background. But I imagine still you spend all night working and you come to the end of the day, or excuse me, the end of the night, the sun's coming up on the horizon, you caught nothing. How do you feel? Probably not so great, right? And anyway, that's where the story, in my opinion, gets really interesting, because this is where insult gets added to injury. And we're going to move on to the second part of the story, what I call an uncomfortable meeting. An uncomfortable meeting. Take a look at verse 4. Just as day was breaking, Jesus stood on the shore. But this is an important piece. Listen to this. The disciples did not know what? That it was Jesus. So to them, this person on the shore is just a guy. Probably if this, depending on where the sun is rising and all that stuff, he may just be a silhouette on the beach. Somebody out there, maybe coming to maybe buy some fish early in the morning before it gets started, I don't know. But either way, verse 4, Jesus shows up. Verse 5, Jesus said to them, "Children, do you have any fish?" And they answered him, "No." He said to them, "Cast the net on the right side of the boat, and you will find some." So they cast it, and now they were not able to haul it in because of the quantity of fish. Now, this is just like the most embarrassing story in the world, isn't it? I mean, let's just think about this for a minute. How embarrassing this is. Some stranger on the beach. First of all, what does he call them in verse 4? Children. These are grown-up men. They got hair on their chest and everything. They smell bad. They've been working all night. They've been doing this for a lifetime, most of them. Probably apprenticed as fishermen from the time they were young with their father, right? And this guy on the beach says, "Hey, kids." That's one thing. Then he asks them, "How did it go, guys?" And you know how it's like. When you go to try to get something, and if you don't get it, how great do you feel about reporting that to everybody who asks? Because what is everybody going to ask? "So what'd you get?" And they have nothing to show for it. Now, at least they're honest, and they say, "No, I didn't catch any fish." And then this is where it really gets bad. Because then this guy who's on the shore, now, what does that tell us about his career if he's on the shore? He is probably not a professional fisherman, right? Because if he were a professional fisherman, he would be in his own boat out somewhere getting his own fish and doing his own thing. He's an amateur on the side of the seashore there, the lake shore, yelling out, "Hey, you professionals over there, I've got an idea. Maybe you were just throwing the net on the wrong side of the boat." As if all of the fish had been literally swimming along the right side of the boat, trying to avoid, "Oh, they're going to go on the left, so let's all swim over here." That is how it works in Finding Nemo, but that is not how it works in real life. The fish are not nearly as coordinated and intelligent as we would like to think. Otherwise, we wouldn't have fishermen, because they would never catch anything. So this nonsensical advice is given to them by somebody who's not a fisherman after he's already embarrassed them by pointing out that they haven't caught a thing. Now, the amazing part of this story is they decided to throw it anyway. Because I would be like, "Forget you, buddy. I'm tired. I smell bad. I want to go home and get a nap. I've been up all night." But instead, they cast out the net, and here's the worst part. It works. oh, doesn't that bug you when somebody who doesn't know very much about your career gives you some harebrained idea and then it actually works? That just burns you, right? It worked, and now they can't even pull the net in because of the quantity of fish. Now, I want you to notice something. John, who is one of the sons of Zebedee, used to be a professional fisherman too, okay? He's the one writing this story. This is his biography of Jesus. So he's a firsthand eyewitness of this story. Verse 7 says this: that disciple whom Jesus loved, that's the way he would refer to himself instead of using his own name. That disciple whom Jesus loved therefore said to Peter, what? It's the Lord. Now, how did he know that? How did he know that was Jesus? He can't see. There's something about it. He's too far away, or the lighting isn't good. How does he know it's Jesus? And I'll tell you how he knew, because John, in that moment, had a flashback in his head. A flashback. And what did he flash back to? And maybe you've had some of these where you remember something really powerful from your past in a moment in time. He remembered the very beginning of their journey with Jesus. The very beginning time when they decided, you know what? I'm going to give up being a fisherman and I'm going to follow Jesus around, even though I've never trained for that in my life. I'm going to give up everything to start a new whole life. He remembered the beginning when he and James and Simon Peter were just simple fishermen minding their own business, and this crazy new teacher named Jesus standing on the side of the lake was teaching, and then he goes up to the fishermen and says, hey guys, you catch anything? They said no. And then Jesus is like, well, tell you what, let's go back out and throw it on the other side, and when you do, we'll see what happens. And Peter goes, you know what? I think it's a dumb idea, but because you ask me to, Jesus, I'll go do it. So he goes and does it, and they can't pull in all the fish. The exact same thing happened. And back then, at the very beginning of their journey, this is the miracle that convinced them to leave their old life and start a new life with Jesus. This is when they realized Jesus was more than just a great teacher. There was something supernatural about this Jesus. You want to read that story? You can look it up in the book of Luke chapter 5, verses 1 through 11. So here they are, years later, fishing at the same lake, getting fishing advice after a failed night again, catching a huge catch again. Who else could it be? Of course, this is Jesus. Jesus had come looking for them. Do you notice this is not a coincidental meeting? This isn't Jesus just wandering around. Oh, hey, Peter, good to see you again. It's been a while. Where have you been? It wasn't like that. Jesus came looking for them. He had a purpose for them. And I want to suggest to you that Jesus knows exactly what Peter intends by hopping in that boat. Jesus is not naive. You can call him a lot of things, but he was never naive. Jesus knew Peter at his very core, and I think he knows that Peter is trying to walk away from him. So when John yells out in the boat, hey Peter, it's the Lord. I wonder if he said it the way my kids say it to each other when I walk into the room and they're doing something they're not supposed to be doing. It's Dad! Because if I'm Peter, am I really thrilled to see Jesus right at that moment? Is that when I wanted Jesus to show up next? Do you ever just want Jesus to show up in the middle of the worst thing you could possibly be doing? Isn't it fun to be caught doing something you're not supposed to be doing? Or would you be a little bit worried about what Jesus might say and do right here in this scenario? Now take a look at the passage again, back to verse 7, okay? I promise we're getting there. Are you with me so far? We're doing all right? I feel like a rookie again. It's been 3 whole weeks, so I'm trying to get back into this. Verse 7. So we'll start over. That disciple who Jesus loved therefore said to Peter, it is the Lord. When Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he put on his outer garment, for he was stripped for work, and threw himself into the sea. Verse 8. The other disciples came in the boat, dragging the net full of fish, for they were not far off from the land, about 100 yards off. Now, some people look at this as Peter is so excited to get to Jesus that he can't wait for the boat to get there. And he's going to jump into the water, and you see him like chariots of fire, you know, running, running to embrace and hug Jesus, and this is where the story turns and everything's great. I'm sorry, I'm not convinced. I'm not convinced that Peter is excited to see Jesus and can't wait to get there. In fact, I'm wondering if he's throwing himself into the sea for another reason, maybe a Jonah kind of reason. But anyway, look at verse 9. Verse 9 says this, when they got on land, they saw a charcoal fire in place with fish laid out on it and bread. And Jesus said to them, bring some of the fish that you have just caught. Verse 11, so Simon Peter went aboard and hauled the net ashore full of large fish, 153 of them. And although there were so many, the net was not torn. I'm not convinced that Peter was excited to see Jesus, because when Peter gets to the shore, the text doesn't tell us anything about him running up to Jesus. In fact, I think he's standing in line just wet. And Jesus goes, hey, bring some of the fish. And instead of Peter going and talking to Jesus, Peter volunteers to run back onto the boat to drag it back onto the shore. I'm thinking he's that kid who is so eager to be away from his mom or dad when he's in trouble that he'll do any chore or anything just to kind of get out of the heat-seeking missile range. You know what I'm saying? And even if I'm making that up, you know what? I think there's at least some fear and nervousness on the part of all of these disciples. What is Jesus going to say? What is Jesus going to do? This is a tense moment. Take a look at verse 12. Verse 12 says this. Jesus said to them, come and have breakfast. Now, none of the disciples dared ask him, who are you? They knew it was the Lord. I think everybody's nervous. Oh, boy, this is Jesus. You can tell they're not comfortable with Jesus yet. They're nervous about this. What is Jesus going to say? What is Jesus going to do to us? How is he going to punish us? He caught us trying to go back to our old life. And so naturally, Jesus serves them breakfast. That's a little weird, right? I mean, sure, they're hungry. I get that. And sometimes you have to feed a man's stomach before they'll even listen to you. Ladies, you probably can identify a little bit with that. But it's weird that you show up on the beach expecting to get bawled out by Jesus, and instead you realize breakfast is already made. And it's almost like Jesus is like, hey guys, come on, come around the fire. Have a seat. We had a campfire here Friday night at church. And I just had so much fun sitting around a campfire, cooking hot dogs and marshmallows and all that stuff, just shooting the breeze with people. That's what Jesus was inviting them into. Hey guys, come on, have a seat. Come have some breakfast. Jesus was like that. Jesus always seemed to do that. Whenever you were really impressed with yourself and you would expect Jesus to give you a pat on the back, that was often when he would deliver his most stinging rebukes. And let me tell you, Peter had experienced that a couple of times. But you know what was also interesting about Jesus? Whenever you felt low, whenever you felt guilty, whenever you were filled with shame, whenever you came expecting condemnation, Jesus was the guy who would often tell you to get up, go, and sin no more. Or make you some breakfast. One of the things about Jesus' appeal is he keeps us guessing. But I'll tell you this, Jesus knows that Peter needs more than breakfast here. Third part of the story. Jesus knows that Peter needs to hear what I'm calling a devastating question. A devastating question. Verse 15. When they had finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, Simon, son of John, what's his question? Do you love me? Now, did you see that coming? I didn't see it coming. As I'm reading this story, I'm expecting Jesus to maybe get out the whip. Hey, Peter, why did you bail on me? There's a question, right? Hey, Peter, when I needed you, where were you, Peter? Hey, Peter, when I needed somebody to defend me, why were you denying that I even existed? That you even knew me? Hey, Peter, why did you betray me? Hey, Peter, why did you disobey me? Hey, Peter, why didn't you follow through on your commitments for once in your dumb life? Instead, Jesus cuts through all that garbage and he says the question that mattered most to Jesus. Hey, Peter, do you love me? It blows my mind that of all the things Jesus wanted to know in that moment, that he could have asked Peter about and had every right to harass him and barrage him with questions about. The one thing he wanted to talk to Peter about, the one thing he wanted most from Peter, was an assurance of his love. I wonder in that moment if Peter's mind flashed back to when that scribe came up to Jesus and said, "Hey, Jesus, what's the most important commandment? We got like 600 and some. What's the biggest deal in the Bible? What's the, like, if you had to sum up the Bible into one commandment, what would it be?" And Jesus said, "Here it is, buddy. You ready? You ready for this? This is going to blow your mind. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, with all your strength." Now, why would Jesus say that? Because that one command sums up all of the other questions. It is the summation of everything God has ever asked of us, and it boils down to love. What Jesus wanted from Peter all along was his heart, his devotion, his love. And did you notice he doesn't just ask him once, does he? Let's keep reading verse 15 again. "Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these?" He said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." And he said to him, "Feed my lambs." Verse 16, he said to him a second time, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" He said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." He said to him, "Tend my sheep." Verse 17, he said to him the third time, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" And I love that we get this next sentence. It says this: Peter was grieved because he said to him the third time, "Do you love me?" Why do you suppose he's grieved that it happened a third time? Do you think he's got a memory that's bouncing around inside of his head right now? One time, I don't know him. Two times, I don't know him. Three times, may God cause me to burn in hell. If I'm lying, I don't know him. Do you love me? Do you love me? Peter, do you love me? And Peter says, "Lord, you know everything. You know that I love you." This was a devastating question for Peter. But I don't want you to go home today and think that this is just a really tough day in the life of Peter, because this devastating question isn't just for Simon Peter. This devastating question is for each one of us in this room. Because friends, I got to tell you this. Jesus wants your love. Jesus wants this thing you're doing to be personal. He wants more than just respect as a teacher or a moral example. He wants more than your admiration as a miracle worker or a martyr for his faith. He wants more than your faith, your acceptance, your head knowledge. He wants more than your obedience. He wants more than you're just doing what he says, living up to his standards and following his moral code. He wants your heart. He wants to not just be a relationship in your life. He wants to be the relationship that defines everything else. And this is one of the reasons why people walked away from Jesus, because he wants everything. And guys, in the end, that's what it means to make Jesus your treasure. It means to grab Jesus' hand and dive into the deep end of the pool with him, to point all of your devotion at him before anything else. See, let me try to give you an illustration of this. Marriage is not just some calculated decision that you make with another adult to share living expenses and tax breaks together. You could pitch it that way to some people. Hey, you get to share tax breaks and living expenses. It'll be cheaper. What is marriage? Marriage is jumping into the water together, hand in hand, determined that you're going to either sink together or swim together. Marriage just doesn't work if your heart is not plugged in. Now, we understand this even though we're horrible at actually doing it. We get it. Marriage is meant to be an investment of your heart. So let me ask you this question. Why would you suppose that your relationship with Jesus is any different from that? Why are we willing to settle for numb, dutiful obedience to God instead of passionate devotion to his heart? Why do we offer Jesus the scraps of our lives? Whatever's left over at the end of the day, whatever's left over at the end of the week, and we believe that that is good enough. Now, I get it, okay? There are millions of reasons to pull away from Jesus and hold back your love from him. Because it's scary to lose control of your life. If I'm calling the shots, at least I know what's going to happen. We think we do. Sometimes we're not sure he really loves us back. How can I really give myself to somebody who I'm not sure loves me back? Sometimes it's guilt. I'm not enough. I haven't done enough. I haven't obeyed enough. I haven't lived well enough. I just got started. I don't know enough. Whatever it is. And sometimes it's just that our attention has shifted to something that's shinier and prettier and more attractive that gives me immediate pleasure. And so Jesus doesn't seem like a big deal in that moment. But either way, we have our reasons for holding back from God and just kind of drifting. Just hanging around the edges, giving something. So you can't say I don't give anything, but giving just enough that you don't have to give what's at the center, which is your heart. And like Peter, we hop in a boat of our own devising and we decide we're going fishing. If you're there or if you've been there in your life, then I want you to hear this devastating question. And I want it to pierce you as deeply as it pierced Peter. Look at verse 17 one more time. Notice how Peter responds. It says, Peter was grieved because he said to him the third time, do you love me? And he said to him, Lord, you know everything. Did you catch that? You know everything. I think what he's trying to summarize there is, you know my failures. You remember what I did wrong. You know how I screwed up. You know that I talk a big game and I have trouble following through. You know everything, Jesus. But then he says this, you know that I love you. See, for Peter, this devastating question cut through the shame, cut through the guilt, pierced his heart, and in the process, it actually revealed to Peter that he really did love Jesus. See, sometimes I think we walk away from Jesus because we think Jesus is cool with it, and Jesus will just take us back whenever, and we don't realize that we're wounding him. But when we see that our sin wounds Jesus, it pierces our heart, and it causes us not just to feel guilty, but to want to do anything we can to show him how much we truly love him. And sometimes we need these devastating questions to make us realize that even though we fail, even though we walk away, even though we make mistakes, even though we lose sight of what matters, in those moments, we always come back to this abiding deep love for Jesus. And it's like the song says, there's no going back. There's no going back. Once you give your heart away, friends, it's over. That squishy little 9-pound squirming, screaming, pooping mess that you take home from the hospital, guess what? It doesn't matter what that child does. That child has your heart. It's just the way it works. When you give your heart away, it's over. There's no point at that point in quitting, giving up. It's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. Oh, but I mess up, so I shouldn't try anymore? No, you get back up and you say, Jesus, you know everything. You know how I've messed up. You know the mistakes I've made. I am not running away. I am not quitting. I am not going back to my own life. Jesus, I want to join hands with you, and I want to dive into the deep end of the pool, and we're going to sink together, or we're going to swim together. And that passionate surrender is what Jesus wanted from Peter, and what I think Jesus wants from us. If you're filling in your blanks, what's the second step to making Jesus your treasure? It sounds super obvious, but after we've been through this story, it's probably not so obvious, and that's love him. Love him. And before you tell me that's super easy, is it really? Is that really easy? Is it easy to love somebody you've never seen with your own two eyes? You've never heard his voice talk back to you audibly? Is it hard to fall? Is it hard to maintain that? Is it hard to really give your full devotion to another person? Are you kidding me? It's like the highest price you could possibly pay. And that's why there's so few of us that are willing to actually pay it. But I got to tell you something. You can't make Jesus your treasure half-time. Making Jesus your treasure cannot be a part-time pursuit in your life. It's got to be all. Jesus is not going to satisfy your deepest cravings of life if you are unwilling to come to him with your whole heart. It just doesn't work. We can't ask Jesus to fill in the gaps of our life. We need to come to Jesus and say, Jesus, this is my life. Take it. And then fill in the gaps with whatever else you want to fill that with. So friends, step two in this make Jesus your treasure step-by-step guide for beginners is just love Jesus. Now, as I close, I do have some suggestions for how to get started, right? I want this to be practical. I don't want you to walk out of here going, oh, some warm fuzzy, I need to feel something different. Okay, fine. I hope you all feel something different for Jesus at some point, but you and I both know growing in love is not just growing in your feelings for somebody. It's more than that. There's some things we can actually do, some suggestions I want to make as we close. Number one, I want to suggest this to you. If you want to actually try to love Jesus, like for real, not just in a religious-y, churchy way, but you want to be real about this, you want to dive into the deep end of the pool to sink or swim with Jesus, then I want to suggest this to you. Number one, share your heart with Jesus. Share your heart with him. It blows my mind that I have to say this out loud, but I think I do. We have to talk to Jesus about what's really going on inside of you. It is not good enough to recite pretty prayers you get out of a book. It's not good enough, even if that book is the Bible. To pray a psalm to God is wonderful, but to pray what's really in your heart to him is how you share your heart with Jesus. If your goal is to do more than just respect Jesus, if you want to love him, you've got to talk about how you feel. You've got to tell him what you think. You've got to tell him what you like. You've got to tell him what you hate. You have got to be involved in this process of sharing your heart. And for some of us, that is really, really hard. Because there's some stuff in our hearts we don't like to share that we just soon pretend don't exist. But if you want to love Jesus, you got to share that with him. And I would also make this suggestion as well, as a part of the same one. As you're sharing your heart with Jesus, ask him to speak back to you. Do it. Invite him to engage with you. Don't just have some one-way communication where you're like, here, God, blah. In the process, say, God, this is who I am. Now, please, God, reveal yourself. Show yourself to me. Talk back to me. Now, how does God do that? The second step, listen to Jesus, okay? So share your heart with Jesus. But number two, listen to Jesus. Jesus does that in many different ways, but at least two. One, and the most clear way that he speaks to us is through his word. He tells us what he thinks about us every single day if we're willing to open up and look at it. Oh, I don't know how God feels about me. Well, you might want to read the book he wrote because it's filled to overflowing with descriptions of how he feels about you. And you can embrace that and you can anchor your life to that. But I would also suggest to you, and I'm sorry to get a little bit experiential here, Jesus is going to know how to communicate directly to your heart in moments of peace and moments of pain and in moments of suffering. The Bible talks about God leading us and guiding us by his Spirit inside of us. There are moments where I am sitting and I'm talking to Jesus and I get a sense from him as to what I ought to do and how I ought to obey him and what I need to move. Sometimes I'll be listening to a song and I'm overwhelmed in that moment. It's almost like I hear Jesus tapping at my heart going, hey, Toby, we picked this song today for you. Melissa didn't pick it for you. I picked it for you. Because I want you to hear this from me. God does that all the time. And when you start to open up your heart to that kind of a two-way relationship with Jesus, crazy stuff happens. Love happens. Love happens. And then the third thing, and this is my final statement to you guys, and then I'll be done. Keep moving closer to Jesus, and he'll move closer to you. This is a principle. If you want to get closer to Jesus, then you take the first step. You reach out to Jesus, and then as you reach out to him, he will let you see more of him. Look at this beautiful verse from John chapter 14. Jesus answered him, "If anyone loves me, he will keep my word." That's me taking a step closer to him. I love you, Jesus, and so I'm going to do what you asked me to do. And as we do that, notice what God does in response. My Father will love him, and we will come to him, and what will we do? Make our home with him. Does that sound personal to you? Does that sound right at the depths of your need? When you're crying, where do you usually go? Somewhere in your house, some safe corner, when you can close the door and nobody can bother you and you just cry into your pillow or cry into your closet or wherever you are. Guess what? If you move towards Jesus, he will move towards you and he will make his home with you. And he'll be there for you in those moments. And I'm telling you what happens. I wish I could tell you that he always fixes everything right away. But what I promise he will do, and what he promises he will do, is in that moment he will be with us and build his home with you. And if you want to make Jesus your treasure, you've got to pry the crowbar and pour open that heart that God gave you inside. And if you've been spending all of your passion on 100 other things, maybe it's time to cut some of those things out so that you got a little bit of passion left over to point towards the person who loves you more than you even can comprehend. And maybe that's when we'll find the cravings of our hearts satisfied, when we actually make Jesus our treasure by loving him. Because when we love him, he is eager to show us his love for us. Let's pray. God, there's so much more that needs to be said, so much more that I probably could say that I'm not saying, so many more maybe tips or ideas but I just pray, God, I think like Peter, so many times we hold back our heart. And God, this week, all week long, I kept hearing that devastating question, do you love me? And it blows my mind that you actually care whether or not a puny human like myself loves you. And yet you do. As I crave the love of my children, you crave the love of your children. Because you're convinced about your love for us. You're not wandering. You don't have wishy-washy moments. You don't go back and forth. You are committed to us. And we bounce back and forth. We're up and down. We're great one minute, and then we stab you in the back the next.